Log Talk Radio.
Welcome to Philosophy in Action. I'm Greg Perkins, here with philosopher Dr. Diana Shea, where we answer your questions, applying rational principles to the challenges of real life. For those listening to the podcast, please join us live, where there's a text chat to chime in with your follow-up questions and witty comments. The show airs Sunday at 8 a.m. Pacific, 9 a.m. Mountain, 10 a.m. Central, and 11 a.m. Eastern Time at philosophyinaction.com. At the site, you can also submit and vote on questions for upcoming shows and browse the archives from past shows. Now, with all of that out of the way, let's jump over to the star of the show, Dr. Diana Shea.
Happy Sunday, Greg. Happy Sunday. Greg, where did you go? Hey, wow, it's technical problem Sunday. Greg, maybe you can find your way back here. I really do wonder where he's gone. Folks, we have a great set of topics on tap for this week on resisting arrest, enjoying Atlas Shrugged, stigmatized property, and more. We've got like all kinds of technical problems. Super awesome. Folks, if you're listening live, you can post questions and comments over in the text chat at philosophyinaction.com/live. Oh, good. Okay, so Greg is out on Blog Talk or on Skype, like his connection just hung up, so hopefully he'll be back. And until that point, I guess I can tell you my news, which is pretty much that I don't have any news. It's been a heck of a week for me personally. I'm sure there's more to come, so I'm just trying to work myself through that and continue doing the show, and all that's going fine.
Wow, that was amazing timing. Hello. Our internet just went out suddenly.
Oh, that's always nice. That's always nice.
But just dead, down.
Yep. Yeah, and then it's always like waiting for things to reconnect. And
Yep.
Well, we are ready to go on question one, so feel free to conga us, and then
Is that the resisting arrest one?
Yes.
Okay.
Hey, folks, this is Diana Brickle, and I just wanted to give you a heads up before we head into the questions. This was the worst live show I've ever done. Not in the sense that I wasn't prepared or that we had technical problems, but in that somebody showed up in the chat and was posting disgusting, horrible comments of illegal acts, illegal sexual acts with children. And I paused the show at one point after two comments had been posted, and I had to go and log in to try to be able to boot him out of the chat room. I was able to boot him out and delete the comment, but he kept coming back and I couldn't actually ban his IP address. And so I was very distracted throughout the show. Greg was distracted. Everybody in the chat room was distracted. It was just a really horrible experience for me. And I'm obviously very, very sorry that that happened. I'm going to see if I can address this with my chat provider to make sure that we can get an actual ban. And I have actually reported what happened, which started off with an email to me last night. I have reported that to the relevant federal authorities. So, hoping that this will never ever happen again, but you'll find weird breaks in the show, and that's because there were times when I had paused and was trying to get him out of the chat and so on, and trying to take care of business so that it wouldn't simply be a completely horrible experience for us all who were live. So, that's about it, and without further ado, here is your first question.
Resisting arrest. How should the police respond to people resisting arrest? Recently, Michael Brown in Ferguson and Eric Garner in New York City have made headlines because they were killed by police officers who, many feel, used excessive force during their respective encounters. While the two cases were quite different, they did have one thing in common. In both cases, the officers were compelled to use force, which resulted in lethal injury when the men, Brown and Garner respectively, resisted arrest. Brown attacked Officer Wilson and then ran away, refusing to stop until Wilson chased him down. Garner refused to be arrested. Is there a more objective way to deal with an arrest in a free society? Since in a free society, the government has a monopoly over the use of force, does that mean that the police are allowed to use brutal force when a suspect refuses to comply with the officer's demands, regardless of the charges against the person in question?
So I don't actually want to go into the particular cases. I just because they're complicated, and I'm pretty sure that I don't have all the facts, and that it would be very difficult to get to come to a rational judgment about that. And that's just not the point of the question. I will say that oftentimes the cases that capture the public attention, that get big protests and riots or whatnot going, they're not always the best of examples, right? For some reason, it's hit a spark in the public imagination. But as the facts come out, you know, maybe the person in question wasn't, you know, wasn't quite so so innocent as is thought. But in general, what we're seeing, and I think one of the things we're seeing because people now have handheld video recorders with them all the time, is that the police are sometimes torturing people and they're murdering people, and sometimes they're not held accountable for that. Sometimes there is no video, and so goodness only knows what happens. Sometimes the video can be misleading. Maybe the video shows only the latter half of an encounter, and the facts maybe only emerge. I also think that what I'm seeing on Facebook, certainly, is that people's responses are heavily, heavily politicized. So people rush to judgments before they know the facts, based on whether they tend to think, well, the police are a protection against barbarism, or like, wow, the police are all brutal thugs. And I think both of those views are wrong. The proper judgment depends on the particular facts in any given case. I think there's general reasons for being concerned and being suspicious when we see a case of police violence. But, you know, facts are facts, and we have to pay attention to those. Now, I will say, it's terribly, terribly wrong to say, as what is said in this question, that in these particular cases, the officers were, quote unquote, compelled to use force. Now, literally, they were not compelled to use force. Nobody put a gun to their heads. But it's also not true, even in the colloquial sense, that, well, wow, this was the only decent option in a dangerous and difficult circumstances. They weren't compelled by circumstances either. I think in this case, they chose to use force. They did have other options. And there are two people dead as a result. And I think that deserves serious investigation, even if we ultimately say these officers acted in justified defense of themselves or others. So I think it's important not to misuse language here.
Yeah. Okay. So what's the basic problem with the kinds of cases that we're seeing reported so often lately?
So the problem is not just that, well, some few cops, some rogue cops are dangerous, out of control. It's not just a problem of a few bad eggs that we need to eradicate. There is this deeper cultural problem in police departments of a warrior cop mentality, where police adopt a kind of us versus them mindset against the very people that they ought to be protecting. And the drug war has undoubtedly hugely, hugely contributed to this. Racism can be a factor, including, I will add, by minority cops themselves. And this is a kind of newsflash for conservatives, because oftentimes there's a claim, well, this couldn't possibly have been racially motivated because, you know, one of the cops is black, or the police captain here is black, or the particular cop in question is black. But From how I've heard this described from people who are actually in police departments, and just from what I know about cultural affiliations and so on, and psychology, there's definitely this phenomenon where a minority cop might feel the need to prove themselves, or want to be part of their new tribe of cops. That's what actually matters most to them. And so sometimes those are the people who are the worst racists towards civilians of their own race. That's certainly possible. That seems to happen. So you cannot say, just as you can't say you're white, so therefore you're racist, you can't say you're black, therefore you can't possibly be racist. That's not how racism works, in either direction. Now, if you want to know more about these kinds of problems, the cultural problem that we're seeing among police, I would definitely recommend reading Radley Balko. He's not anti-cop. He is anti-warrior cop. He's anti-rights violations. I've been reading him for years and years and years. He's really excellent. Both his blog that's now on Washington Post, and also he's got a book called The Rise of the Warrior Cop. So definitely recommend him as a really good objective source of information on these kinds of issues.
Interesting. Okay, so what's the solution to these cultural problems then?
Yeah, so I think there needs to be massive change in police departments away from this warrior cop mentality and towards community policing. The leadership needs to insist on that. Whistleblowers need protection. Police departments need to confront and eradicate their pathological subcultures, which might not be just one cop. It might be a whole department. And I also think that decent cops need to see pathological cops, pathological departments, as threats to them, not as their buddies that need protection. And this happens in lots of professions. This certainly happens in the military and medicine and so on, where there's this, like, it is this us versus them mentality. But I think that people need to realize that sometimes the them is your very own buddies. I also think that the drug war needs to end. It's not just a violation of rights, but it's a massive, massive excuse and rationalization for police brutality and misconduct. Marijuana legalization is a big, big first step towards that. And even if other drugs are not legalized, it would be possible for drug war enforcement to be ratcheted down. The focus could be on crimes that have actual victims as opposed to merely the drug trade. And that would be huge. That would be important. I also think that police actions need to be transparent and subject to scrutiny. Anyone should be free to record the police. The police need body cameras on them all the freaking time. That's protection for themselves. It's not just some kind of means to incriminate them. They should regard that as, I'm protecting myself so that I'm not going to be wrongly and falsely accused of wrongdoing when I didn't do it. I also think there should be massive penalties for police who lie in court, or who destroy footage of cameras and so on. Those are huge, huge problems, and oftentimes the justice system just gives that a nod and a wink. And those are just a few suggestions. Again, Radley Balko would have more. Highly, highly recommend his work.
Very interesting. Okay, so what should the general principles of police use of force be?
So the problem here, as far as I understand, is not that we need a new set of principles. I think the principles are actually pretty good. And one of the ways you can see this is looking at, since I live near Denver, the opening statement of the Denver Police Department's policy on the use of force. So I'm going to read this to you guys. It's actually a bit long, but I think it's worth reading because it's actually quite, quite good. Quote, "The Denver Police Department recognizes the value of all human life and is committed to respecting human rights and the dignity of every individual, and the constitutional right to be free from excessive force, whether deadly or not, by a law enforcement officer. The use of force, especially force likely to result in serious bodily injury or death, including a firearm, is a serious action. When deciding whether to use force, officers shall act within the boundaries of the United States and Colorado constitutions and laws, ethics, good judgment, this use of force policy, and all other relevant Denver Police Department policies, practices, and training. With these values in mind, an officer should use only that degree of force necessary and reasonable under the circumstances. An officer may use deadly force in the circumstances permitted by this policy when all reasonable alternatives appear impracticable and the officer reasonably believes that the use of deadly force is necessary. Officers should ensure that they do not engage in unreasonable actions that precipitate the use of force as a result of tactical, strategic, and procedural errors that place themselves or others in jeopardy. The reasonableness of a particular use of force must be judged from the perspective of a reasonable officer on the scene rather than with the 20/20 vision of hindsight. The calculus of reasonableness must embody allowance for the fact that police officers are often forced to make split-second judgments in circumstances that are tense, uncertain, and rapidly evolving about the amount of force that is necessary in a particular situation. The reasonableness inquiry in an excessive force case is an objective one. The question is whether the officer's actions are objectively reasonable in light of the facts and circumstances confronting them without regard to their underlying intent or motivation." And
that is fantastic. I have to, sorry to interrupt.
Yeah,
but that very closely matches, and it's a nice statement of what we were actually talking about in the prep meeting.
Yep.
So there you go.
Thumbs up nice. On that. Yeah. So let me continue because there was another paragraph that I thought was quite good. Quote: "Policing requires that at times an officer must exercise control of a violent, assaultive, or resisting individual to make an arrest, to protect the officer, other officers, or members of the general public from risk of imminent harm. Officers may either escalate or de-escalate the use of force as the situation progresses and circumstances change. Officers should recognize that their conduct immediately connected to the use of force may be a factor which can influence the level of force necessary in a given situation. When reasonable under the totality of circumstances, officers should use advisements, warnings, verbal persuasion, and other tactics, and recognize that an officer may withdraw to a position that is tactically more secure or allows an officer greater distance in order to consider or deploy a greater variety of force options. When a suspect is under control, either through the application of physical restraint or the suspect's compliance, the degree of force should be de-escalated accordingly." Close quote. Like, as you said, Greg, like, this is a really good policy.
Yeah, this is solid. It's exactly what I would want.
Right. But this is also from a department that's known for police brutality. that has a, at the very least, a pretty serious image problem, and that definitely has this warrior cop mentality in some, at least in some quarters, and certainly from the, you know, public person, just as somebody who lives outside of Denver, this is certainly their reputation is on the warrior cop mentality. So just because there's good principles doesn't mean that the practice or the culture is actually all that great.
Indeed. And I see this as an extension of a self-defense use of force principle that we already have, which is, okay, if you must use force, use force, even deadly force, and then be prepared to defend it. You have to be ready to be scrutinized.
Right.
Because nobody gets to use force in our society with it just
willy-nilly.
At will. Yeah.
Yes. Yes, absolutely.
All right. So if maybe some of the challenges are in the interpreting what's really going on. So what should count as resisting arrest?
So this is just my very much my layperson's view of this, and informed somewhat by this Denver Police Department policy, but this is sort of a philosopher's armchair take. So A, beware of that. Okay, one. First of all, ignoring a request is not necessarily resistance of some kind. And the Denver Police Department policy actually discusses that. It says, quote, again, this is really good, quote, "It is important for officers to bear in mind that there are many reasons a suspect may be resisting arrest or may be unresponsive. The person in question may not be capable of understanding the gravity of the situation. The person's reasoning ability may be dramatically affected by a number of factors, including but not limited to a medical condition, mental impairment, developmental disability, physical limitation, language, drug interaction, or emotional crisis. Therefore, it is possible that a person's mental state may prevent a proper understanding of an officer's commands or actions. In such circumstances, the person's lack of compliance may not be a deliberate attempt to resist the officer. An officer's awareness of these possibilities, when time and circumstances reasonably permit, should then be balanced against the facts of the incident facing the officer when deciding which tactical options are the most appropriate to bring the situation to a safe resolution." Close quote. So that's important. That's good. Secondly, I think that asking questions of an officer in an attempt to understand that police officer's reasons for detaining or arresting you or giving you some kind of command, that does not count as resistance. I've certainly seen that taken as such in multiple videos, particularly where people are simply trying to video an encounter with a third party, a police encounter with a third party, and the police take any kind of questioning or anything as resistance. I would even say that even arguing with the cop isn't substantive resistance, right? It's not a reason to arrest the person or to escalate the use of force. It's one thing if the person is, you know, running around and waving their arms and seems completely unhinged. Like, that might be one thing, right? But if the person is simply saying, "Look, officer, I do not understand why you are giving me this order. Why am I not allowed to videotape, you know, what's going on here across the street? I'm standing on the sidewalk. I know what the law is. I'm allowed to do this. Why are you telling me to put away my phone or to delete the video I've already taken?" That does not count as resistance. That should not count as resistance. Third, I think that a person attempting to flee, absent grounds to think them dangerous to others, is not a good grounds for using overwhelming or deadly force. I think one should be really careful about that. Yes, this is a problem, but that's not necessarily a reason to draw one's weapon and fire. Fourth, I do think overwhelming or deadly force is justified in the same circumstances, basically, as self-defense, when a cop is reasonably in fear for his own life or limb, or for the life and limb of others. That's when that would be appropriate. And the question ultimately asks, quote, "Since in a free society the government has a monopoly over the use of force, does that mean that the police are allowed to use brutal force when a suspect refuses to comply with the officer's demands, regardless of the charges against the person in question?" Close quote. And my answer is, like, absolutely freaking not. Are you freaking kidding me? No. The government's monopoly over the use of force does not justify rights violations. It doesn't justify tyranny. And so if somebody tries to walk away when a police officer is questioning them about some, you know, a minor shoplifting incident or something like that, right? That does not justify drawing one's weapon and firing. So, yeah. Or, you know, indeed, tackling them and taking them down in a way that, you know, what might result in broken limbs and so on. No, like, no. One should use the minimal amount of force necessary. And again, you want to take care not to be judging people with this 20/20 hindsight and to give people room for making these split second decisions. But I think it's really important to hold the government to a high standard here and say, look, this is your job to figure out how to de-escalate, how to use as little force as possible. This is your job. That's what you need to be doing.
Indeed. They're trained for that, even though it is a difficult circumstance to always being put in a situation of danger, to be engaging, random people. But at the same time, they are trained professionals. And
right.
If they can't function well in that gig, someone else needs to do it instead of them.
Right.
All right. A lot to think about. What's the take-home point?
I think the culture of policing in America is fraught with serious but far from universal problems of police misconduct and brutality. The police need to be restrained in their use of force so that they protect rather than violate rights. That's the general principle.
Indeed. All right. A little bit of follow-up here from KPOM. He asks, what about broken windows policing policies?
I think a lot of that is victimless crime. Like, some of that is legitimate. Some of that is property damage, and that should be taken seriously. Some of that is basically an excuse to harass, people. And so I don't think that you can particularly say one way or the other, oh, this policy is great, this policy is bad. But I think that there's definitely concerns about particularly putting people into the system, because that generally does not improve their lives.
I did look up the broken windows policing policy and it reminded me that, yeah, it's based on the theory that if you strictly enforce zero tolerance over little offenses like breaking windows, that in an urban area it would improve overall crime levels. So,
right.
Yeah. Okay. No other follow-up here. No other follow-ups here. So it's time for the reminder about the tip jar.
So Philosophy in Action Radio, not just the live show, but the podcast too, is available to anyone free of charge. That's because we want to spread rational principles far and wide. We do that with every show to thousands of listeners, but we can't accomplish that alone. We do rely on the support of our fans. So if you value our work, please do contribute to our tip jar. You can visit philosophyinaction.com/support to send money online or via the mail. We suggest $5 per episode or $20 per month, but any amount is welcome. And also, you can create a recurring monthly tip via PayPal, Dwolla, or your bank's bill pay. Then you don't need to remember, and you get free access to Philosophy in Action's premium content. And we really appreciate that regular support. Again, you can do that over at philosophyinaction.com/support.
Enjoying Atlas Shrugged. How can I be less annoyed with Atlas Shrugged? I love Ayn Rand's ideas, and I thoroughly enjoy her nonfiction. I want to enjoy Atlas Shrugged and her other fiction more, but I'm often annoyed with the aesthetics of her work. I acknowledge the fact that the novels are great, but every time I see mention of Francisco's mocking smile, or John Galt's mocking eyes, or Hank Reardon's mocking laugh, or John Galt's implacable voice, or New York City's implacable skyline, or Dagny Taggart's silent terror, I just want to pull my hair out. I find myself wanting to throw the book at the wall every time she uses those words. I understand that loving her novels is not a prerequisite for applying her philosophy, but I really desire to experience the joy that many other people feel while reading her work. How can I get more enjoyment out of it?
So sorry, I'm still trying to figure out if I can boot somebody from the chat. It's amazing, honestly, that we haven't had more of these kinds of problems. Okay.
Yeah.
So first of all, as folks know, I love Atlas Shrugged. It's amazing, amazing plotting and integration. And it's something, Greg, I'm getting an echo. It's only something that I fully appreciated once I really knew the novel thoroughly, basically once I did a number of discussion groups and created the Explore Atlas Shrugged podcast. But that doesn't mean, as much as I love Atlas Shrugged, it doesn't mean that I think it's the height of literary perfection and that there's no aesthetic flaws in it. I do think there are some aesthetic flaws, and some of them are actually pretty major. So that's what I'm going to discuss here, but please do keep in mind the broader context here about how much I love this novel, which is really, again, it's evident from my Explore Atlas Shrugged series of podcasts.
Okay. So are these criticisms warranted in the question? Is that precise language used, and how much? What are the ratios we're talking about here?
Yeah, so mocking is a word that came up like 10 times or something. I did a search of Atlas Shrugged. So that shows up, but implacable definitely shows up more. And that's a funny term because it's not a common a common term that showed up about the same amount of time. So, you know, yeah, there's some of this language in here. The question is definitely exaggerated. It's exaggerated for deliberate effect. So some of the particular phrases are actually used, some of them are not. But there is a certain style of language, particularly that we find generally in Ayn Rand, in her fiction, but particularly in Atlas Shrugged, that might reasonably grate some people the wrong way. And it's not just that Atlas Shrugged is written in this as this hard-boiled detective fiction, which is sort of cool. Hey, that might not appeal to some people. But there are this use of words that the questioner suggests here, words like mocking and implacable, suggest a kind of feel of indifference to or even contempt for other people. And I think that's part of the reason why some people do react so strongly against the novel. It's not the only reason, but it's one of the reasons why people have this kind of icky feel of like, this is not my worldview, this is heartless, this is cruel, is because there's a way in which even the heroes will interact with each other that seems sometimes heartless and cruel and mean is not quite the right word, but in that vein.
Huh. I never noticed that, and it makes sense. I did notice, though, that the frequency of word use, like implacable, I think jumped out at me. There were a few words where I was like, it grated on me because at least in the modern lexicon, they were still showing up at a ratio. It was just too high. The frequency was just too high. Right. But that, I tried to shrug it off. I was like, well, you know, she wrote this 50 years ago and might've been doing something for a certain effect. I don't know.
Okay. So here we go. Restarting after the minor debacle there. So moreover, another problem with Atlas Shrugged is that the characters do feel a bit too much like archetypes. Their values and words are sometimes too interchangeable. They're not fully individual persons with all the strange turns and quirks of real people that we even see in The Fountainhead and We the Living. And this is one of the things that I really, really loved about the book The Martian, is that this is this guy. He's an amazing hero. He's so super rational. And yet he is this fully individual personality with his own set of quirks and values and so on, and very clear personality. And that, I feel, in some ways is what's missing from Atlas Shrugged for me. Another thing, the speeches are a disaster. I mean, really a disaster. Francisco's money speech could and should have been written as this witty dialogue, this repartee with multiple opponents in the room. Galt's speech, you know, it has philosophical value, but it kills the flow of the novel. And I don't think it's persuasive or even really comprehensible to either the intended audience in the novel or to the novel readers. And, you know, like, by all means, publish that or publish an essay on this philosophy. Publish it at the end of the book. I do think there's this way in which the speech needed to be included because this was the thing that Galt told people to get them to go on strike. I think that the idea that Galt could convince people to go on strike by that kind of thing is productive geniuses to go on strike by such philosophical verbiage is unrealistic. And I understand the need for that, but I don't know, maybe the problem is this deeper unrealism of thinking that you can persuade people of your philosophical values by that kind of method. Anyway, all of that being said, there is so much that I love about the characters and characterization in Atlas Shrugged. There's Hank Rudin's moral transformation. There's Lillian Reardon's deviousness. There's Francisco D'Anconia's wit. There's all kinds of just really, really great stuff about the characters and the characterization in Atlas Shrugged. But I do think that there's also problems. And people react to that. They do, in fact, see that. They don't like it. I understand that.
All right. So how might this person learn to love the novel more?
Yeah, so I think there's a couple strategies here. One that I would recommend that other people really don't seem to ever agree with me on, but I'll offer it here, is to avoid the audiobooks. I haven't listened to the Scott Brick version, but I found that Christopher Hurt is snide in this way that made me hate the novel for many, many years. And that once I stopped listening to the audiobook and started reading it for myself, which I'm loath to do, I love audiobooks, it got so much better. So just beware of that. Okay, so that was point one, avoid the audiobooks. Greg, did you want to add something on that one?
Oh, no, I was just going to use your next point to vamp while you were dealing with the asshat there.
Oh, no, no. yeah, no, this requires too much concentration. We need to do full stop if he shows up again. So secondly, when you read, I would recommend that you focus on the elements that you love. Focus on perhaps the integration in the plotting, the portrayal of ideas, the aspects of the characterization that you do love. And just let the rest go if you can.
Yeah. And that's actually what I do. The integration and the plotting are just amazing for me. And I admire it and enjoy that when I'm reading it.
Right. Right. So Stuart Hayashi mentions in the chat, he says, Christopher heard his snide. I thought he sounded too robotic. That too. I don't know. Like there's a lack of emotion in there, and there is this, but it partially comes across as snide to me, but robotic sounds right too in another way. So, but Tom Hall loves Christopher Hurt's reading. So if you love it, you love it. That's great. I have no problem with that, but
yeah,
you might
it
not.
Could be a personal reaction thing. Tammy and I both were fine with his reading. We liked it.
Yeah. Thirdly, listen to my Explore Atlas Shrugged podcast as you read. That will help you focus on the better elements and help you get much more out of it. Ultimately, though, this is point number four, it's okay if you don't like Atlas Shrugged for these aesthetic reasons. It's okay not to like Ayn Rand's fiction. Just accept that and move on. Now, that being said, there is some major dangers of just understanding Ayn Rand's philosophy of objectivism through her philosophical writings. I think that there's a lot that's in her philosophical writings that's very abstract, that's very top-down. There's lots and lots of politics. There's lots more sort of condemnation and moralizing. The fiction has this subtlety, including a focus on emotions and experience and psychology, that can be really important for understanding the feel of the philosophy. And I think that's important. So beware of missing that aspect of it.
Okay. Very good. What's the take-home point?
So Atlas Shrugged is an amazing novel, but it does have some aesthetic flaws that can impede a person's enjoyment of it. By all means, try to overlook those, focus on what you love, but if all else fails, just give up and move on and find some fiction you do really enjoy.
Stigmatized property. Should sellers of homes be obliged to report the spiritual or criminal history of the property? Many state laws require that stigmatized properties, such as those with a history of paranormal activity or a past owner such as Jeffrey Dahmer, be reported by real estate agents. That leads to the home being devalued in price. Should such a law exist? Moreover, should potential buyers take advantage of any stigmatized property, thereby offering and paying less, even though belief in paranormal activity is irrational?
This is a nice mess to untangle. Let's dig in here.
Okay, first up, what does the law say about disclosures? And what should it say?
Yeah, this is mostly state-by-state law, so this is easy to Google. It's worth Googling if you're selling or buying a home. Mostly sellers are not required to disclose spontaneously, but instead they are required to disclose if they're asked or if they know that a buyer is concerned about some particular issue.
Yeah, and that makes sense to me. That goes to a meeting of the minds necessary for a proper deal.
Yeah, I mean, I need to know that I'm buying a house with massive foundation problems if this is going to count as an actual sale, right? We need to make sure we're agreed upon what the item is that's being bought and sold. But generally, states do have certain mandatory disclosures, and because these are mandated by statute, they tend to be really, I don't know, it's an odd assortment. So in Colorado, you have to disclose if there's an HSA that you're obliged to pay dues to. That seems reasonable to disclose that. If the property has been used as a meth lab but has not been fully remediated yet. Okay. You have to disclose what the home's source of potable water is. You have to disclose if there's any proposed transportation projects, such as a light rail project, that may affect the property. And you have to disclose if the property is in a special tax district. And that really is an odd mixture. And there's surely different ones in other states. But also, it's just the case that, I mean, as sort of silly as this list would be, there are standard forms for sellers to fill out, and that makes it reasonably easy. So it's not like this is the most burdensome possible law out there.
No, it's just it's jumping out as haphazard and concrete bound, though.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Now, I think the law, let's think about what the law should say. The law, one option is for the law to say, look, the sellers have to disclose anything that any reasonable buyer would be interested to know, such as foundation problems or major repairs that are due, or like what the source of potable water is, or if this house is a meth lab and it's still, you know, full of horrible fumes or whatnot, or, you know, HSA dues, those kinds of things. A lot of the mandatory disclosures in Colorado would fall under this, hey, any reasonable buyer would be interested to know this. Certainly, if the property is subject to routine vandalism or groupies due to some past crime, that would likely need to be disclosed under this kind of rule. On the other hand, it might be significantly better, it might be easier legally and result in less paperwork and more flexibility for changing circumstances if the law simply, or if the law basically was that the government didn't need to have any special role here other than preventing fraud by requiring honesty in any and all disclosures. So buyers, it might be basically on the buyers to know and to ask all of the relevant questions. Preferably they'd be asking questions in an open-ended way. They would have realtors perhaps to help guide them about here's the form that you should submit to the seller so that they have to disclose all the kinds of things that can be a problem. But I don't know that it matters. I tend to like the second option better, but ultimately I'm not sure that they're actually all that different in practice.
Yeah, maybe the end result would be the same, but I'm with you. I would prefer that the government not have any particular laws about real estate. It should be just worried about clean transactions, preventing fraud. And that includes somebody misleading you through omission or commission on a transaction like this.
Right.
And especially if you have a professional involved, they can be held to, professional standards. I mean, it's like, yeah, you should know the questions to ask as the buyer's agent. You should know the things to disclose as the seller's agent.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely.
And our friend is back.
Yeah.
Yes. I have deleted him and banned him again, which apparently that function does not work as quite as well as I had thought.
All right.
Yeah, and I'm actually open to the argument that we might need some specific laws for what counts as fraud in real estate transactions. There might be some particular kinds of things that only come up with real estate, because this is a very special kind of property. It's one of the, you know, it's basically there's personal property, there's real estate. It's like it's its own major category. So. But I think that you have to justify that. You have to have a good reason to say, look, we need some special rules for real estate. Here's why this doesn't apply to personal property.
Indeed. All right. So how should the law deal with the spiritual history of a house?
So I don't think there's a need for special laws here. If a prospective buyer is interested, this is something he or she should ask about. And I think the difficulty lies in how to answer this question, particularly in today's cultural and legal climate. Right? Now, in theory, given that a supernatural haunting is always pure fantasy, a person should be able to say just no, and that would be the end of that, even if the house is widely believed to be haunted, right? And although that's the truthful answer, right, there is no spiritual history to this house.
If my house has ghosts, I'm just going to say I don't believe in ghosts.
Right.
Next.
but that could get you into legal trouble. Because the question is not really, do you believe that there are ghosts, but do some people or do people generally believe that there's a supernatural influence here, right? So what I'd recommend is that you say something like, you know, well, there's some urban legend about that, or some people think that, but God, it's just so silly. Everybody knows that ghosts are imaginary.
Yeah.
Right?
Get in. That's going to be only retards would believe that.
Yeah. That's going to actually be offensive to the person who seriously believes in ghosts to have their views dismissed that way. And guess what? In this case, that's actually a really good thing. House sales, house transactions, real estate transactions are difficult business, and you do not want to be doing business with somebody who is doused in crazy sauce, right? So contrary to my usual advice, in this case, do not be too tactful about it. And I would also say likely that's safer than just decline. Like you could say, dude, you believe in ghosts. I'm not set. Like, like that much, I'm not selling you this house. That could actually be grounds in today's legal climate for an anti-discrimination suit based on religious beliefs. You do not want that. So just be a little bit offensive. I think that's actually a really good strategy in this case.
That's actually a good point, given our goofy legal system. Had not thought about that. Okay. Signing on with the offensive response.
Yes. I mean, I think that's the first time I've ever advocated that. As a policy, generally, yeah. I'm like, you know, like, be honest, but be tactful. No. In this case, be honest and be a little bit offensive.
Okay. Drive them away. Now, what about the proposal to take advantage of these homes by buying and reselling them?
This seems like a bad strategy to me, right? Because if the problem is such that the culture is irrational enough that you can buy these homes at a steep enough discount, then it's unlikely that you're going to be able to flip them and sell them in a good way. You know, these, and I don't think the culture is actually that irrational, and there's just not that many of these homes around that people think are haunted. So that tends to be a staple of television shows like Supernatural, but it's not actually something that happens on an actual regular basis. So yeah, go ahead and try if you want to, but don't blame me if you don't. Don't earn the tidy profits that you had been hoping for. Yeah.
Yeah. Reasonable point. Okay, what's the take-home point?
So the law should forbid fraud in real estate transactions, and that likely does not require any that likely shouldn't require any mandatory disclosures. Instead, buyers should ask about what they're interested in with open-ended questions, including, if they care, the spiritual and criminal history of the house.
Fair enough. It doesn't look like we have any follow-up action here. So moving on. It's time to put Diana on the hot seat. It's rapid fire question time. I'll ask questions from this long and growing queue in any old order. A lot less preparation. Much more interesting stuff could happen. So, hey, does the counterintuitiveness of the Monty Hall problem demonstrate an inherent flaw in the human capability to reason? Notice that I'm trolling you right now to get people wound up about it.
So I actually recently revisited the Monty Hall problem. And go Google it if you want to know what this is. It's about goats versus cars behind a door and what the whether you should switch doors or not.
Yeah. Conditional probability problem.
Yeah. And rereading the standard explanations for what's going on. Rereading the standard explanations for what's going on, I'm actually fairly unsatisfied with them. Like there is a grinding of the gears in there, even, you know, going through all the explanations. And I recently read a post by Sasha Volok on this that said, hey, like, there's something else going on here. Like, he didn't like the standard explanations either. And I thought, like, that's it. That's, you know, like, he had hit on something. Anyway, so go Google the Monty Hall problem if you're interested in this. Go Google Sasha Volok's commentary on it that was published in the Volok Conspiracy blog. And go see what you think. But this is not some inherent flaw in the human capacity for reason. If it was, we wouldn't be able to figure this out at all. It's just something controversial and seemingly counterintuitive and so on.
Yeah, indeed. When that actually happened, I have a little bit of a background in math and I hang out with geeks. I remember having a long, heated debate with somebody. It's pretty easy to end the debate about what is the proper action to take in the problem. What we were actually debating was the elegance of how to explain that to people, the clarity, the forcefulness of laying it out for someone. And we had each had different approaches that we thought was the one true way to really get it through someone, that this is the way to think about it, and not that way. So it was I'm with you. It's probably just that it's very hard to explain it in a way that's clear for people to think. So it's just,
yeah,
you found a good case.
Yeah, I mean,
and
Sasha
has actually tripped up smart people.
Right. So one thing I would note is that originally the controversy when Marilyn Vosavant published her answer about this was about what the correct answer is. Sasha agrees that that's the correct answer, but the question is, why is that the correct answer? And is it because you've gotten new information when one of the doors is opened or not? And so anyway, so I think there's no debate about what the correct answer is. The question is why. And I thought that was actually a pretty interesting discussion.
Yeah, there's no debate now, but for a while there was. Fairly sharp, respectable people who were jumping
saying pretty horrible things
answer.
About.
Yeah,
about
it was just
her.
Like no, yeah. not. So that's why we were focused on, you know, what's the way to explain it so that even the smart people would say, yeah, that's obviously the correct answer, and not me debating it. So it's a neat corner case.
Right.
Okay. Hey, here's one that's nice and lighthearted for the day. Is rape about sex or power?
I think it's probably about both. Like the idea that rape is not about sex, but it is about power. That's a bizarre view, because somebody is not like, they are not, let's say, going after men or women to hold them down and lick their faces. Like, there's a sexual component to this, to what's happening here. And that's what makes it rape as opposed to other kinds of assault. But it's not just about like, this person really wants sex and that's why they're raping people. That's also not true. I mean, it says
it's
something about
amalgam.
A person.
They're,
yeah, that they are. It's about both of these, and it's about having. I mean, and also, I would say motivations for rape could be very different. The psychology that would motivate it in one case would be different from the others. So I don't know that you can say like universally, here's what it's about. But it's not the case. This is. I mean, I think the it's about power, not about sex, is part of why. I mean, one of the reasons to say that, or at least to say, look, it's not just about sex, is that women wearing short skirts and men wishing to have sex with them, that's not what causes rape, or that's not enough. Like, the woman didn't cause a man to rape her because she wore a short skirt. Like, that's not what that's about. Just because you are sexually alluring as a woman or as a man, that's not the reason why you were raped.
Okay. And a little technical here. How do we know that the mind is tabula rasa?
Oh, good God. I don't think I can answer that question today. I think we'll save that for another day. Like, just all that's been going on with the chat, and I'm like, I've got the chat window up, and I'm like, ready for the next thing. Like, I can't even think of that. So, Greg, unless you want to answer that, I think I'm like,
well,
my brain is just toast.
I think it's a pretty involved thing, but I think the explanation would come down to discussing how conceptual products are products of a certain kind of process. And so if you haven't done that process, you can't have the product. You can't have... built in an effect of something without having the cause. So the cause is engagement with reality, doing certain integrations, taking certain actions, and here's the product. So no, you can't have the product built in.
Thank you. That gets me started. The other thing I would add is that tabula rasa is about there not being conceptual content. And so again, like this is how we acquire concepts, is by this particular process that requires evidence from experience and sensation and perception and so on. But that doesn't mean that nothing about the mind, like the mind is diaphanous, or that there's nothing about the mind that is set at birth or that's innate. There can be lots of things, issues about or aspects of a person, personality and so on, can certainly be innate, and that does not violate tabula rasa.
Yeah, I sorry, that is a really important part of the discussion, is to say, you know, what is it we're discussing and what is it we're not? So the mind has a nature, you've got emotions, you have inclinations and personality stuff, all these things that aren't conceptual content.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
Okay, we need to conclude here, because I'm actually so overwhelmed by what's happened in the chat that I really literally can't even
sorry.
At this point. Yeah.
Hold on, scrolling down. Okay, we're out. Pulling the ripcord.
Yes.
Okay, it's time for us to sign off from another episode of Philosophy in Action Radio. Thanks for listening. We hope you all had a great time.
I would say I had a fantastic time, but oh my gosh, the chat. Oh, that was so horrible. So I'm so sorry, people who were actually live and in the chat. That was truly, truly horrible. Thank you for bearing with me, and I really hope that those of you who are listening to the podcast have no freaking clue what I'm talking about here, that there's no evidence that I managed to get it all out of the podcast. So Wow.
One guy messes it up for everyone.
Oh,
we'll have to work on the process to deal with those kinds of disturbances in the future.
Yeah, well, I think I need to talk. I need to message Rumble Chat, who's my chat provider, and say, dude, your banning function is not working, because I think that's likely the problem. Anyway, once again, thank you to our generous contributors. With every episode of Philosophy in Action Radio, we bring you ideas that engage the mind and help you live better. Plus, we introduce thousands of other listeners to the principles they need to live virtuous, happy, and free lives. We think that's hugely important, and we do depend on your support. So if you want to contribute, just go to philosophyinaction.com/support. Oh, good. Greg is out now. Alrighty then, God, this has just been like one of the most difficult shows ever I've had to do. If you want to see what's on tap in the next few weeks, visit philosophyinaction.com/upcoming. And that's it. I am signing off. I am done. I'm out. Okay, so let me play my final music, and then thanks everybody. Bye. Have a good day.